So we're almost at the end of the book of Judges. We only have two more stories left. The first one we're going to look at today, chapter 17 to 18. We didn't read chapter 18, but it's really an extension of chapter 17. And then one more sermon, we'll finish it off for the final story of chapters 19 to 21. And these two stories are a wee bit different from what we've had so far in Judges, because we don't meet any more judges. There are no more judges. Samson was the last one that we looked at last time, and his death at the end of chapter 16 appears to be the last chronological event in the book. And yet we have these two added stories, and they're kind of like a double appendix to the book of Judges. And it's as if the narrator is saying, you know what, you've heard enough about the judges, let me tell you now about the people. Because up until now we've only had really brief summary statements about the people themselves. We keep on reading again and again that they did evil in the eyes of the Lord. But what did that really look like? It's such a terse little statement that is given. What did it look like that they did evil in the eyes of the Lord? I mean, how bad was it? And so we get two final stories, not about the judges, but about how bad it had become among the people. The first one that we're going to look at today shows how unbelievably screwed up their religion had become. And then the last one shows how unbelievably depraved they had become. So basically it's a complete religious mess that we're looking at today, and then a complete moral mess that will finish us off. It's a fairly depressing book in many ways, isn't it? And what we see today is that the Israelites needed saving. Yes, but not from the Midianites, not from the Philistines or the Moabites or the Canaanites or the Ammonites. No, the very grim but poignant conclusion to this book shows that the only people Israel really needed to be saved from were themselves. And the reason it's relevant for us here today, so many hundreds of years later, is that our greatest enemy in the Christian life is not militant Islam, for example, and it's not secularism. It's not any external threat that will ultimately undermine our witness or threaten our faith. The greatest enemy in the Christian life is the same as it was for the Israelites all those years ago in 1100 BC. It's our sin. It's our sin that lies within us. It's the way that we're prone in and of ourselves. We're prone to be a complete religious and moral mess. We really are. I'm not sure, does anyone play bowls? I'm not sure if anyone has ever played bowls. I think I've only played maybe a couple of times in my life, but you know how a bowl is weighted? You try and roll it straight, in a straight line, and depending on what way you're holding it, it of course either curves off that way or it curves off that way. And a good bowler knows how to work that to his advantage, but one thing it doesn't is roll dead straight. And that is a picture of the sinful nature, because we all keep turning away. We all keep veering off what we know to be right. And everyone has this nature from day one. You know, no one ever teaches a baby to do wrong. And yet no baby has ever grown up not to do wrong except Jesus. And therefore the human problem is not merely that we have all done and keep on doing wrong things. No, the human problem is that we're bent that way. It's a deeper problem than just the bad things we might engage in. It's actually the human heart. It's how we are. And I don't mean to say that, you know, we all live immoral and lawless lives. What I mean is that in our nature, we grew up to live for the glory of our own name above the glory of the God who made us. And that's true even when we do good things. Yeah? Even when you do something really good. Look at me. Oh, really, it was nothing. You know, we're so prone, even in the good things that we do, to want to get the praise and to be at the center. And that's what sin is. It's the bent that we have. It's the nature that we have to rob God of his glory and take it for ourselves. It's how we are. And you really can't read the book of Judges and fail to see how screwed up human nature is. That we don't naturally worship God above all else, as he really is. That we don't naturally put others above ourselves. And it doesn't matter how much instruction you get. It doesn't matter how much education a person receives. It doesn't matter how much help and encouragement a person is given. I mean, you can give your kids a lot of teaching and encouragement and get them to conform to a certain code of conduct, as perhaps we have done. But at the end of the day, their human nature is still their human nature. Which is exactly why Jesus said that we have to be born again. We have to be given brand new hearts that actually treasure God above all else. But I'm getting ahead of myself because we've got to get into chapter 17. A man named Micah from the hill country of Ephraim said to his mother, "Mom, you know how your entire life savings went missing? You know that extraordinary amount of money, 1,100 shekels of silver that somebody stole from you? Remember, it was so bad that you pronounced a curse over that rotten thief, whoever it was? Well, the thing is, I took it," says this guy Micah to his mother in verses 1 and 2 of chapter 17. And before we think, "Oh wow, well done Micah, well done, what a guy for owning up," what he did was clearly despicable. And note that his confession is not even an apology. He doesn't appear to be returning the money out of remorse. He just doesn't want that nasty curse on his head. Which brings us on to the fact that this chapter is about the complete religious mess that they've got themselves into. First of all, though, his mom is extremely gracious. "The Lord bless you, my son," she says. I'm really not sure why the Lord would bless Micah. But nevertheless, all is forgiven as far as his mom is concerned. And there's no kind of, "Now, Micah, let's talk about this. Why did you do it, son?" There's none of that. There's no, "Do you understand that what you did was wrong? That you deserve to be punished? And, you know, are you truly sorry, Micah? Have you sought God's forgiveness?" There's none of that kind of chat. Micah's mom completely ignores the heart issues and just moves on, which is a deadly mistake when it comes to parenting. But anyway, she is gracious. She certainly is a believer. She talks about the Lord, and she clearly believes in the Lord. And we might say, great, what a gracious believer and generous too. She solemnly consecrates her silver to the Lord, verse 3. That seems a very generous thing to do, doesn't it? No worship of Dagon, the Philistine god, in this family. No, sir. Here is a good, upstanding family of faith in the only true and living God. Bravo. And then we see how horribly, horribly mixed up this family is and their worship. What does what does his mum want to see done with the money? I mean, she says that she consecrates it to the Lord, but what does she want to see done with this money? She wants a carved image and a cast idol. The very thing God commanded his people never, ever to do. What's the second commandment? "You shall not make for yourselves an idol." How can the living God possibly be represented faithfully by a lump of stone or a lump of wood? I mean, it's crazy. It's impossible. Anytime you make an image of God, anytime you try to paint a picture, it will always be reductionist. You know, how could it not be? Think of the rich character of God, every aspect of his being. How could every aspect possibly be represented by one image? It's impossible. And even if you could somehow manage to incorporate every aspect of God's character, how could you show everyone equally and fairly in relation to all the others? You couldn't. You can't possibly be faithful to the revelation of who God is by making something. Possible. Make an image of God and he will be misrepresented every time. It's inevitable. An eternal and an infinite God who created all and sustains all simply cannot be known accurately by any image or statue or picture or icon. And that is why traditionally in Presbyterian churches we have very simple buildings, we have very simple worship, we focus on the word because we know God through his word. And it's just a joke to think that we can make something to help us think of God better. Now at this point, we're in great danger that we begin to feel a wee bit smug. Well, we don't do physical representations of God. We major on the Word of God. So that must mean we're keeping the second commandment, right? Well, what if your heart desires God to be different than he really is? What if we have him in our minds as something other than he really is? What if our choices betray that we really want to squeeze him into our mold? Anytime you hear somebody say, you know, I like to think of God as this, dot, 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 then you're encountering a breach of the second commandment. I like to think of God as all-loving, but not as judge. I don't like that bit. Or I like to think that he's only concerned with personal morality, but not social justice. I don't really have time for that. Or perhaps vice versa. I have time for the social justice, but I don't like to think that he cares that much about my personal morality. Or I like to imagine that his favor can be earned, that if I do this and do that, then God will really, you know, accept me and love me more. Or I like to imagine that Christ is Lord of many aspects of my life, but not everything. If we ever think anything like that or behave accordingly, then we may as well have a big shrine in the corner of our living room as much as Micah did. Because we're fashioning God into an idol that does not represent who he really is. You might like to think that I support Man United or Chelsea, but unless I actually tell you how absurd that is, nobody could ever know. God has to tell us in his word what he is really like. And we're not free to imagine him in any other way. And it's worth asking then, you know, are we getting to know God more and more through his word each day? Or have we maybe settled for an image of him in our minds that we find good enough, that we're not that keen to get to know him more and more as he really is, but we figure we have him sussed and we'll settle for that. We're really not that different from Micah's family, I don't think. And they're in a right religious mess by the end of verse 4, because here's this shrine that they have made. And by the way, Micah's mom is not only guilty of idolatry, she's also guilty of dishonesty. She's a hypocrite. Verse 3, she says, "Oh yes, I give all my 1,100 shekels of silver to the Lord." Verse 4, to the silversmith. See what you can do with just 200. She talks a good talk, but she doesn't really put God first. She keeps back 900 shekels for herself. And of course, you know, if you imagine God to be like all the other deities of other religions, then you would keep back 900 for yourself, because if you don't know and trust God as he really is, then you can't be too careful. What a religious mess this is. Hypocrisy, idolatry, and it's basically their own homemade religion. They even worship at home. You know, forget the tabernacle where God said worship was meant to take place in those days. Micah wanted his religion to be more convenient. He even sets up his own priest, or his own son, as priest, which is another transgression of God's law, because the Levites were set apart and reserved for the priesthood. But Micah, he wants it to be more convenient. He has his own personal preferences. I'll have my own religion in my own living room, and my own son will be my priest. It seems farcical, and yet I wonder, is it really much different from the consumerism that is rife, even when it comes to how we worship nowadays in our society? You know, we've so many personal preferences, don't we, when it comes to worship? The time, the place, the style, the music, the duration, the size, the car parking, the comfort, the friends, the coffee, et cetera, et cetera. And you know, all those things are important in their own way. You know, we want to get those as right as we can, so that worship is as helpful and beneficial for everyone. And yet, you know, sometimes do we have the wrong focus, and do we sometimes maybe stay at home because it doesn't meet our personal preferences? or it's not that convenient. Many times when I was growing up, I went to worship thinking only about what I wanted to enjoy, rather than eager for God, for what God had to teach me, and how I could bless and encourage the people around me. And I could be very religious, and yet completely miss the heart of what worship is all about. In verse 7, it goes from bad to worse. The problem is not just with Micah, and not just with Micah's family. The problem is with the entire religious establishment in Israel. We're introduced to a young Levite, who significantly at this point is unnamed. He is nameless. All we know is that he's a Levite. In other words, he represents the whole tribe of Levites. Why is that important? Well, Levites were the ones set apart by God to be priests. They were meant to be the spiritual leaders of Israel. So we know that if the Levite had been any sort of Levite, he would have turned Micah back from his iniquity. Surely he would have said, "Micah, what are you doing?" But what happens? Instead, the Levite says, "Micah," he sells his own professional services to Micah. He sells his own professional services as a priest to this perverted homemade religion. And Micah thinks he's onto a winner, you know. If he can have this professional Levite as priest instead of his own son, then all the better. It looks much more impressive. But this Levite, I mean, what is he doing? Joining in with Micah's idolatry. And then in chapter 18, we didn't get time to read chapter 18, but in chapter 18, the Levite sees an opportunity to further his career, and he sells his professional services to the whole tribe of the Danites, who are so impressed with Micah's shrine that they steal both it and his priest. The seduction for the Levite is too much. And I was just thinking about this and kind of laughing to myself in my own role as a minister or a pastor. The temptation, the seduction, that would never happen today, would it? You know, what this Levite ends up doing. You know, one commentator writes, "What's better, to be the pastor of a small family or to be the pastor of a mega church?" And so the Levite in chapter 18 further sells his soul in pursuit of his own self-promotion. To be priest for the whole tribe of the Danites. More money, more prestige, and a complete religious mess. And even more crazy is at the end of chapter 18, we find out that the Levite is actually the grandson of Moses. How fast can things plummet? How fast? I mentioned one time in a sermon before here that, one generation knows the gospel, the next generation assumes it, and then the third generation denies it. It can happen that fast. It happened from Moses to his grandson. And the whole thing is so twisted. Both Micah in chapter 17 and the whole tribe of Danites in chapter 18, they really believe that if they have this shrine and this Levite priest, they really think that the Lord will bless them and be good to them. That's how chapter 17 ends. Micah says, great, now I've got the Levite as my priest and my, to operate at my shrine, and the Lord will now be good to me. And you're just like, what in the world is he thinking? Micah just reckons that God is there to help him to get what he wants. And isn't that basically familiar? That we want God to help us to get what we want. Micah doesn't want a God who makes demands on him. Isn't that the story of the human race? We don't want a God who will make demands of us. Micah just wants a God who can help him out and make his life just peachy. And that's what human beings have wanted ever since Genesis 3. But of course, true faith is not getting God to do what we want, but rather having our hearts so taken by God that we want to do what he wants. Even if it is demanding, and even if it means that life will not be easy or trouble-free, but will indeed be the opposite. And how does that happen? Just as we finish up here, how does that happen? How do we move from just wanting a God that is basically in our own image, who will help us get what we want in our agenda? How do we move from that to actually putting God first, having Him as our first love, and being willing to serve Him, whatever the cost? How does that happen? The answer is that we first of all have to be captivated by the true vision of who He is. We need to see that a God of our own making is pathetic compared to the real God. It's simply any misrepresentation that we have of God is simply not worthy of our worship. But when we see God as He really is, the truth of His power and His compassion, His mercy and His justice, His love and His wrath, that He is King and Father, that He is three in one, that He is worthy of our complete allegiance, and yet came into the world not to be served, but even to serve, and even to give His life for idolaters like us. When we come to see that Jesus died, the righteous for the unrighteous, so that we can be forgiven. When we see the real God for who He really is, revealed through His word and supremely in Jesus Christ. And when we have our eyes open to that, that's when everything changes. And we need to cry, open our eyes, Lord. Help us to see the incomparable Jesus. Because when we truly see Him, we don't want any stupid image. We don't want any ridiculous misrepresentation. When we truly see Him, nothing compares to Him. And we're drawn to Him like a moth to the light. We're captivated in worship. And that's what has to happen. We have to have the Spirit of God come and make us new. The Bible calls it being born again, being given new hearts. That's what has to happen. When somebody truly becomes a Christian, you know, it's not that they think, well, I guess I really should be a Christian. You know, I think rationally I've thought about it and it must be true. So yeah, I'll put my trust in Jesus, I guess. That's not what it is to become a Christian. To become a Christian is simply to be bowled over in wonder and awe and love for who Jesus really is. And I'm not saying the whole Christian life is walking on this kind of cloud nine where you're just in awe all the time about the glory of God in Christ. But nevertheless, our hearts have been captivated. That's what it is to be a Christian. Our hearts do see, at least in part, that there's no one like Him. There's no beauty like His beauty. There's no power like His power. There's no goodness like His goodness. There's no justice like His justice. No compassion like His compassion. No teaching like His teaching. No love like His love. Have you come to that point of seeing who God really is in Jesus Christ? Jesus said Himself, if you've seen Me, you've seen the Father. And so Paul writes in 2 Corinthians 4 that we need to have our eyes open to see the glory of God in the face of Jesus Christ. In those days, there was no king. It says that in verse 6 and again in chapter 18, verse 1. That was the big problem. In those days, there was no king. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes. But we declare today that the King has come. And he reminds us, that even though we're more wicked than we ever realized, we are at the very same time more loved than we ever dreamed. And so we want to know Him more and serve Him all our days, that He may indeed be glorified in our lives as He really is. May God purify our worship, the worship not only of our gatherings, but of our whole lives, to His glory and praise.